produced across the region when it comes to love. And we've got an incredibly authoritative group of speakers to offer their insights and thoughts. On the panel tonight is Turkey's best-selling female author, Alicia Pak, who has written heavily on love across cultures. I've got to mention at this stage that Alicia has been nominated for an award and will be leaving early tonight. So she'll be here for most of the talk, but for the questions, she won't be here for most of it, so please do get your questions in quickly before she heads off. We also have Jennifer Klinek, author of The Temporary Bride, which is her autobiographical account of her marriage to an Iranian man. And Mirza Wahid, author of the Book of Gold Leaves, which looks at the fate of relationship in war-torn Kashmir. Chairing the event tonight is Samir Rahim, who's the Arts and Books editor of Prospect magazine. We also have a youth panel tonight, as we really want to engage with youth and hear what they think and see how the taboos are being engaged with amongst the younger generation. On the panel is Brianna Vogel, Tamsin Paternoster, and Katerina Timoney, so they'll be called upon later on. Please join me in giving everyone a warm welcome.
Great to see so many people here. And we're incredibly excited this evening because we've got a great panel you've just heard been introduced to discuss what promises to be a fascinating topic, one that I've been looking forward to for a long time. The subject of our discussion today is an alluring one. It's love across divides. And now if you think of the great pairs of star-crossed lovers in history, Troilus and Cressida, or Romeo and Juliet, or Layla and Majnun, they were all reaching across divides in some way, whether in a situation of war, or family rivalry, or fatherly disapproval. But perhaps it's also no coincidence that in all these cases, everything ended quite badly. I think in order, disfigurement, suicide, and madness. But nonetheless, despite these rather pessimistic examples, the attraction of the other, the erotic charge, you might call it, which is simulated by the forbidden person and who is some way a foreigner to you from a different culture, from a different family, and from a different religion, is still incredibly powerful. And even more so in our globalized world, where in a city such as London here, teams of people with different cultures, and nature, as you would expect, takes its course as people from different backgrounds meet and fall in love. And sometimes these couplings take place in opposition to strong family and cultural taboos. And for some communities, marrying outside the bounds of the family is seen as a threat to traditional values and their cultural integrity. And there's also the issue of patriarchy. Why is it sometimes the case there's different rules for men in this situation and different rules for women? These are just some of the issues that I hope that we're going to be discussing today. And the three writers I have alongside me have dramatised some of these issues in their work. They've already been introduced, but what I would like to do is just invite them to read a short passage from one of their books, so to give you a flavour of what they're trying to express. Then I'll ask some questions and we'll have a short discussion. And then please do prepare questions and then we'll open it up at the end. So can I first of all invite Jennifer Klinek, who is a Canadian writer now resident in London, and her memoir, The Temporary Bride, tells us a little bit about how she moved to Iran and found love. Jennifer, would you like to read it?
Certainly. Excuse me. So the section I'm going to read takes place in the story when I meet the man in the book. His name is Vahid. So we part and then we agree to meet again, and that's the section I'm going to read. We choose Imam Square as our meeting place, a vast maidan the size of 15 American football fields. We are due to meet somewhere near the fountains in the center, opposite the breathtaking tiled heights of the Shah Mosque. I pass through the stone pillars of the western entry gate, slipping into the open-air corridors that shield me from the sun. The long curved archways of honey-colored stone resonate with the rattling of idling taxis and the giggles of schoolchildren. As I walk, I hear the heavy footsteps of the turbaned mullahs Iranians call cabbage heads. Their surly bodyguards force a path through by shoving people roughly to one side. Young men hopeful of an emigration romance watch out for German tourists, waiting to tell them they have beautiful eyes. I've already dreamt this moment in my head. I know how I want it to be. I hope he'll notice my new coat, how its color makes my eyes seem more green. At the edge of my scarf, I've fastened my hair with a clip to the side to show off the streaks of blonde that have emerged from afternoons in Azadeh's courtyard, exposing my head and arms to the late afternoon sun. It isn't lost on me, all the effort I'm making to go and meet a boy in a square on this clear blue morning. I feel a flutter in my stomach at the prospect, a nervousness that makes me lightheaded. If I had anyone to tell, they might laugh at me, willfully succumbing to courtship here, in this most hopeless of places. I know Vahid's family have consented for him to follow me here only because it could never have occurred to them. When his father had loaned him $50, and his mother had tucked a lunch of lavash, cucumber, mint, and cheese into his travel bag, they were thinking of him as my host and protector. They had imagined the sweet temporary nest, they had enjoyed the sweet temporary nest I had made for myself in their suburban Yazdi home, and smiled at my quirky Western socialization, seeing me as bold and animated where their daughter and nieces were reserved and shy. But they had never imagined the unthinkable. For a traditional Yazdi family, a relationship was a mathematical formula. The correct variables of age, beauty, morality, and finances were entered, and the output was a successful, peaceful marriage. It couldn't be, therefore, that their Iranian son could feel desire for someone 6 years his senior, someone who didn't come to him pure and untouched. I was an amusing visitor from another world, and soon enough I should return to it, fading quietly into an anecdote brought up over tea or a postcard taped onto the fridge, a photograph kept in a shoebox. There was nothing in their minds to worry about, for Vahid could never love such a girl as me. I see him through the crowds before he sees me. He is sitting on a stone bench, his chin tilted downwards. His brown eyes look tired, and his clothes are wrinkled from the 6-hour bus journey from Yazd. Lying at his feet is a worn army duffel bag in the canvas circle of a folded Iranian tent. He'd said he had an uncle in Isfahan, but he has come prepared to sleep in a nearby park among the travelers you see without money for a hotel, families who barbecue chickens and boil kettles on open gas flames. A sense of responsibility for him flares up in me. We are in this new city together, alone.
Thank you. I'll ask Mirza just to read a little bit from his book, The Book of Gold Leaves, which is set in Kashmir in the 1990s and follows two young lovers.
Thank you, Samir. I'm going to read a letter which is smuggled across the border between India and Pakistan because the man of the heroine's dreams has gone across to Pakistan to become a militant. Now, you can't send letters via regular post because it's war. Letters go through Nepal. They're smuggled in little papier-mâché boxes. Papier-mâché is a big theme in the novel. And she writes the letters. They take about 2 weeks to get to about like 100 kilometers from her, but they had to go to Nepal first and to Pakistan. This letter is titled, it's well into the book, he's there training to be a militant and she's left behind waiting for him. Dear Faiz is his name. My winter has been harsh too. It snowed and snowed. So much so that broken electrical cables felt like dead birds across the city. The electricity still disappears for days and we live by kerosene stoves, lamps and candles. It is very dark here now. I didn't tell you in my last letter that the stove had one good effect at least. There were fewer gun battles and explosions in the days we were snowed in. Even the daredevils were stalled for a few days by the freeze, and the soldiers shivered in their pickets. You know, many of them have never seen snow before, let alone live through a long, snowy winter. Sometimes I feel sorry for them. They shouldn't be here. But it's picked up. People are dying again. People are being killed like flies. I mean, there are actual people killed on the streets every day. I don't know if you heard, but they read out the toll on the evening news as if they were talking about the amount of rainfall. I feel frightened. It seems the angel of death is taking away my people. At the shrine, everyone weeps. As I offer namaz on Thursdays, I often hear sobs behind me. I dread turning around. The shrine itself feels like a melancholy place. Do you remember Maharaja, who recorded those voices? He has disappeared or gone into hiding. There are rumors he may be in some jail or dead or in the Paradise Hotel. You know what that is, don't you? Now that he's gone, I miss his nighttime screaming, even his swearing. I sometimes feel scared for Rumi. Rumi is a younger brother who refused to stay indoors. But then I tell myself, actually, it's nothing compared to where you are. How will I cope? What will I do when you come back? Papa hardly goes out, unless he has to. Even then, he comes back quickly. His darbars at the shops have ended, and he's lonely now. He's been feeling more and more scared since Principal Cole's murder. The only good thing I can tell you is that Mummy has changed. She is no longer burdened by thoughts of my wedding. If you ask me what my heart's truest desire is, I would say I want you to come back, but then I cannot be sure when I think about it. Then I think you have to come back someday, so why not now? After all, you did go there to come back, didn't you? Then I think about what will happen when you do, and I don't know, Faiza. It's a strange thing within me, and it's painful. Sometimes I wish I could tell you, I could talk to you on the telephone, you know, discuss it, and listen to you. You haven't changed, have you? I wonder if you think about me at all. You must have bigger things on your mind now, and new friends. If you ask me my heart's desire, I would tell you I want you to come back now. I would tell you I want to join you in your fight. My blood boils too, you know. Some days I imagine blowing myself up near a bunker or one of those monster trucks. But then I think I'd be no use. It'll be no use in the end. There are so many of them here. Maybe I'm more useful alive. I would be very sad if I died without seeing you. The city is a lightless prison. No one can stir without the permission of the soldiers. I sometimes imagine we're in a vast coop with thousands of them circling around it. And they hit out at my hand if I try to get some air. I can feel it, actually, the dumb, the choking inside me. But that's not all. Crammed together in this cage, some have started lashing out at the others. We jostle for breathing space and push at those around us. There is suspicion and, of course, death all around. While the soldiers kill every day, the boys have started killing some of our own. Some of the boys are particularly harsh on the girls, and I don't understand why. You, of course, are not like that. Thank you.
And Ellie, would you like to read something from The Architect's Apprentice?
Yes, with pleasure. So, I'll read it very short. Excerpt from the very beginning. This is the story of Sinan, who was seen as the greatest Islamic architect, but not many people in Turkey talk about this or know this. Sinan was born a Christian. He was most probably Armenian or Greek, and he remained a Christian until the age 21. So his basic formation was in Christianity, and when he became the great Islamic architect, he was asked to surpass the dome of Hagia Sophia. But in my opinion, Sinan saw the dome as an all-unifying, all-embracing concept instead of an instrument of hostility or war. So I try to capture his story through the eyes of his apprentice. Of all the people God created and Shaitan led astray, only a few have discovered the center of the universe, where there's no good and no evil, no past and no future, no I and no thou, no war and no reason for war, just an endless sea of calm. What they found there was so beautiful that they lost their ability to speak. The angels, taking pity on them, offered two choices. If they wished to regain their voices, they would have to forget everything they had seen, although a feeling of absence would remain deep in their hearts. If they preferred to remember the beauty, however, their minds would become so befuddled that they would not be able to distinguish the truth from the mirage.
So the handful who stumbled upon that secret location, unmarked on any map, returned either with a sense of longing for something, they knew not what, or with multiple questions to ask. Those who yearned for completeness would be called the lovers, and those who aspired to knowledge, the learners. That is what Master Sinan used to tell the four of us, his apprentices. He would regard us closely, his head cocked to one side, as if trying to see through our souls. I knew I was being vain, and vanity was unfit for a simple boy such as I. But every time my master would relate this story, I believed he intended his words for me rather than for the others. His stare would linger for a moment too long on my face, as if there was something he expected from me. I would avert my gaze, afraid of disappointing him, afraid of the thing I could not give him, though what that was I never figured out. I wonder what he saw in my eyes. Had he predicted that I would be second to none with respect to learning, but that I, in my clumsiness, would fail miserably in love? I wish I could look back and say that I have learned to love as much as I love to learn. But if I lie, there could be a cauldron boiling for me in hell tomorrow, and who can assure me tomorrow is not already on my doorstep, now that I am as old as an oak tree and still not consigned to the grave? There were six of us, the apprentices, the master, and the white elephant. We built everything together: mosques, bridges, madrasas, caravanserais, almshouses, aqueducts. It was so long ago that my mind softens even the sharpest features, melting memories into liquid pain. The shapes that float into my head whenever I hark back to those days could well have been drawn later on to ease the guilt of having forgotten their faces. Yet I remember the promises we made and then failed to keep every single one of them. It's odd how faces, solid and visible as they are, evaporate while words made of breath stay. They have slipped away, one by one. Why it is that they perished and I survived to this feeble age, only God and God alone knows. I think about Istanbul every day. People must be walking now across the courtyards of the mosques, not knowing, not seeing. They would rather assume that the buildings around them had been there since the time of Noah. They were not. We raised them, Muslims and Christians, craftsmen and galley slaves, humans and animals, day upon day. But Istanbul is a city of easy forgettings. Things are written in water over there, except the works of my master, which are written in stone. Beneath one stone, I bury the secret. Much time has gone by, but it must still be there, waiting to be discovered. I wonder if anyone will ever find it. If they do, will they understand? This nobody knows, but at the bottom of one of the hundreds of buildings that my master built rests hidden the center of the universe.
Thank you, Lee. That's great. I wanted to ask you, there's a line in the book which is relevant to Sinan, which says that destroying a bridge is easier than building it. And I wondered whether you wanted to talk a little bit about the metaphor of the bridge and how relationships between people, whether romantic or in this apprentice-master relationship, can help build bridges between people.
Thank you. I think the bridge is an important metaphor, and love is about connecting to another being. Writing, you know, is also, in my opinion, a transcendental experience. You try to go beyond the boundaries of the self. There's always this endeavor to move beyond. I like to think about the concept of bridge, maybe because I come from Turkey, and Turkey is always seen as this bridge culture. But I sometimes doubt, maybe we feel unwelcome, you know, in Istanbul. Those of you who are familiar, if you drive, you cross the bridge, it says welcome to the Asian continent. You cross to the other side, it says welcome to the European continent. But I think many Turks feel unwelcome in either continent, you know, just in the middle, maybe up in the air. Because with the bridge comes the question of identity, you know, who are we, what are we trying to bridge? So it is an important metaphor for me, and I think in this life it's much easier to destroy, it's much easier to push away than to try to construct and you know, build connections among fellow human beings. That is much harder. Also, if I may add this, I think Turkey is a society of amnesia. That too is a way of destroying, you know, you destroy memory. Our understanding of modernity is very future-oriented. We erase the past, just look forward, which can make a society very dynamic, but our entire relationship with the past is very problematic, it's full of ruptures. So I try to approach the metaphor of bridge from different angles.
Yeah. And speaking about one of your earlier works, a novel called Honor, there's a level of destruction in that novel as well. So in that novel you have a violent killing, a sort of honour killing, in a way, to do with a Kurdish-Turkish lady living in London in the 1970s. She's had a relationship outside a marriage bond and things. So, in that novel in particular, were you trying to explore the ways in which people can feel very vulnerable if they take a risk that goes beyond their immediate community?
Yes. I mean, I wanted to deal with this concept of honour, but at the same time I wanted to stay away from clichés and stereotypes. You know, there's so many cultural stereotypes revolving around that notion, as if it's a problem that only concerns one single community or one part of the world, one particular region. So I was trying to find another door into that story, and therefore I focused on a mother-son relationship. And it's always intriguing to me how, as mothers in the Muslim world, across the Muslim world, we raise our sons differently. I think we raise them as the sultans in the family, with all the good intentions. You know, we treat them differently from day one onwards. And in traditional families, many of those sons grow up thinking they have the right to keep an eye on the modesty and chastity of their sisters and mothers. So in the story, it's the son who wants to punish the mother, but it was the mother who raised him in that particular way. It's much more complicated. So I've always believed that obviously it's very difficult for women, especially young women in patriarchal societies, but I also think for young men, life is not easy either, especially men who do not conform to given descriptions of masculinity, you know, who deviate from that path. There's a lot of pressure building on them as well.
Yeah, Moses, if I can draw you in on that, because in the Book of Gold Leaves, your male main character plays as an artist, but then he gets led into militancy and that affects his relationship with Ruby. So do you recognise some of the things that Alif has been saying about these ideas of honour and masculinity?
Yes, you see what Edith mentioned, Muslim societies. There is patriarchy at work in various forms. Now, when you talk about the big brother or the father figure who has to protect these women with all good intentions, as Elif says, it is just patriarchy in disguise, isn't it? You know, in the novel, even the younger brother wants to keep an eye on his big sister, you know, because he's heard she's been seen with this man from another sect, and he's furious. He's far younger. Because it's ingrained in him that he must make sure that the sister follows rules. And he's doing it to protect her, but it is patriarchy. Now, Fez, who is in love with this girl, he's got a different sensibility. His main obsession, main concerns in life are art and nice things in life. He likes to paint, he wants to paint. And within that framework of his artistic sensibility, the love fits perfectly well, because he loves fine things. He sees this woman and this is it. He's decided it. Of course, those assumptions are challenged as he walks into a fiercely patriarchal framework of war, which is all men, essentially. There is no room for women in that kind of war, and which means there's more distance between him and the girl. He hasn't chosen to be, to keep it that way, but that's how what happens.
Yes, it's interesting, because the couple... Faiz is a Shia and Ruhi is a Sunni, but in the way their Kashmiri culture transcends those differences, and as you say, it's more to do with the circumstances that they find themselves in that causes the difficulties.
Yeah, I mean, it was also my way of turning around the age-old trope, let's call it that, which is, feuding families, opposite sides, they cannot get together, we'll not let them get married. You know, no matter, we'll war, we'll kill each other, but we won't let them get together. There is, at the beginning of the novel, it seems that's what's going to happen. These families are now going to clash because Sunni, Shia, we don't get married, we don't sort of do that. But in that context arrives a bigger force, a more violent force, which is the military machine. Which makes the families indirectly, subtly, make the union possible as opposed to oppose it. Because now they are looking at a far more powerful, violent, overwhelming force, which is war, which is militancy, which is violence. And then that somehow compels them to actually help these lovers. Initially, they conduct the relationship clandestinely, but gradually, because bigger things happen, there's a moment of rupture where he decides to abandon the brush and pick up the gun that eventually leads the families to help them get together.
Jennifer, this is your memoir of going to Iran, in fact, search of recipes, first of all. But as we have, you found more than simply a recipe. You found a man and eventually a husband. And I wonder what it felt like for you as a Western woman going to Iran, which is a very heavily male-dominated society in many ways, and how you were welcomed into a family and how you fitted in.
Yeah, I think it's interesting on two levels. I mean, firstly, when I was preparing to go to Iran, my mindset was, I need to find women. I want to be invited into women's homes. I'll be spending my time with women. Men were really of no interest to me. So I think in meeting this young Iranian man, Vahid, I had completely written him off as anybody who I'd have anything in common with. And in fact, because of the way Iran is, because many young people in Iran were born after the revolution, as you can imagine, so they spent all of their lives being socialized away from members of the opposite mm-hmm. sex. I just found him so gruff and blunt and bossy and unpleasant that we didn't do any of the things that you would do when you're around someone that you would think you might have an interest in. We were both completely ourselves because we had both written the other person off in any romantic way. And in a weird way, I think that in the end kind of pulled us together because we were absolutely 100% behaving like ourselves rather than putting on any kind of a front or anything like that. And the fact that I was invited into his family's home and spent time cooking with his mother, I think for him to see me in a family context somehow changed his mind about me. And I think people thought, when they see you in their everyday life, they see that you're maybe not so different.
And it's a very hopeful book because two very different people get together from different backgrounds and learn to kind of understand each other. But I'm wondering, and I wonder whether this resonates with anyone's experience in this room, that if you do have a relationship with someone who's from a different culture, it puts an awful lot of pressure on that relationship because you become an emblem of something else, something greater than simply two people getting married.
You can do. I think to some extent, as part of the beginning, you become an emblem of something that is doomed to fail.
Yeah.
And that's a very interesting situation to find yourself in, very bewildering in fact that everyone is just waiting for it to fail because everyone can see the odds are all against you. And I think in the situation with myself and Vahid, we had two layers of that. There was all the cultural differences, but then we'd fallen in love in probably one of the most restrictive societies that I can think of. Where when we would be out together, we would literally, if you were Vahid, I would sit with my back to you and we would be talking and I'd be reading my book and having a conversation, so it looked like we weren't together. So we had all of that as well. And interestingly, I think the regime actually helped our relationship because it was very galvanizing for us to fight against that. And it was actually incredibly romantic to all day long be, waiting for that moment where you could, sorry, I'm going to pretend you're Vahid here, when you could grab the person's hand.
I am Vahid.
Yeah. Or steal a kiss. And so often people say to me, oh, didn't it make you appreciate how the freedom we have in the West? The answer is yes to an extent, but also there was something so beautiful about having that courtship be so slowed down. The fact that, you know, here you walk into a bar, the next day you're practically engaged in an Iran. You know, everything was so slowed down, everything was so painstaking, and that was incredibly meaningful for me, and I think for our relationship.
Alif, in one of your earlier novels as well, The 40 Rules of Love, you have a perhaps analogous situation. So you have a character who's a Jewish American lady, and she develops an email correspondence with a Scottish man who's converted to Islam. So all sorts of different things coming together. But that was definitely a moment of unusual connection, wasn't it?
Yes. Maybe it was a deliberate attempt on my part to, because I like that. I'm someone who values cosmopolitanism. I sincerely believe, you know, we learn from people who are different than us. That energy, you know, when different people from completely different walks of life come together, it's a challenge for both sides. I like that. But at the same time, I have met such people. So, for instance, the Scottish Sufi was based on a real person who is a Scottish Sufi. So people think it's impossible, but it's not impossible. This, you know, these stories do exist. But I think my main attempt, and that's why I like, you know, maybe that's my primary connection with the art of storytelling. I don't necessarily see it as a path to tell my own story to others. I want to be the other, and then be someone else, and then someone else. You know, constantly keep traveling, maybe have a nomadic existence. So it was my way of being, yes, a Jewish American housewife in Boston, and then the Scottish Sufi. You know, while you're writing those characters, you can be those characters. So I wasn't looking at them from above. I wasn't like a puppeteer trying to control them. That's an important distinction to me.
And I wonder whether the idea of the cross-cultural romance, why is it still so appealing in literature? I mean, from Shakespeare to Bollywood, do you think it taps into a kind of fantasy that we have, that there's something slightly dangerous or something slightly alluring about the other?
Yeah, totally. I because you mentioned courtship, I suddenly remembered this small thing I did when I was 16, 15. So I fell in love with the Sunni girl. I come from a Shia family. Hopelessly in love, and I fancy her, and I would die without her, of course, and listen to sad songs all night. And she is Sunni, and she's from my school, a year junior, and I don't know how to talk to her. So I go on a bike for tuitions and I circle her house a few times during the day in case she looks out and, you know, looks at me. It never happened. I found my final ultimate chance in a bus, you know, in a bus. So I had this big book. I was pretentious. It was about microbiology or something. And I wrote a letter to her. And I put this letter in this book. And in the bus, I was standing and she was seated. So because I was, you know, struggling with the book and I could have easily put it in my bag. So I just gave the book to her. Can you keep it for now? So that was my moment of triumph. I've got the letter to her finally. And I get off the bus at the first opportunity. In about 2 minutes, one of my friends like these, he comes running after me, says, "You forgot your book in the bus." And I thank you very much. You know, I waited months for this moment. Eventually, I got the letter to her, and she was Sunni. She was much wiser than I was, and she never mentioned the word Sunni or Shia, that this can't be possible. She just said, "Look, you're a sentimental fool. I'm in school and college, you know. I want to do something for now. I can talk about these relationships later, you know." So that was it. It never happened. But yes, it was alluring. And I mean, if I look back, why did I fall for her? Because one, she was obviously stunningly beautiful, and she was amazing, and she was the best girl in the world. And because she was not like me. You know, she was not the kind of girl my mother would pick for me. She was unattainable, which made her more attractive. You know, and that is a very human sort of, you know, thing. That's what happens. And then that's where conflict arises as well, both in the real world and literature. You know, and that's what makes those relationships more alluring, is the word you used, more meaningful in the ways that it can generate more stories.
Well, I'm sure none of you read any of these things, but whenever they have sort of guides to dating or finding a partner, or one of the sort of main rules they always say is you should always look for somebody who's very similar to yourself. You know, somebody who's from the same class or the same background or whatever, and you'll understand each other better or whatever. But I was wondering, Jennifer, you had any thoughts on that, and also, you know, about the sort of the ideal of kind of sameness and being similar as being the sort of ideal of romance.
Yeah, I mean, clearly those guidelines didn't hold true for me because I wound up marrying someone opposite from me in every single way. I think something you were saying, I think it's weird that when opposites do come together, it's amazing, again, the commonality and the beauty that shakes up. I think as soon as things are more complicated, the more layers you have to get through to get to the person, you actually appreciate all of those layers that might be commonplace in any other sort of relationship. And I also found one of the things about falling in love with an Iranian man, being sort of engrossed in this Iranian family, is that actually wasn't that far off from my own upbringing. My parents were immigrants from Eastern Europe. We were the weird people in the neighborhood where we always had a goat roasting on the front lawn or whatever. And actually, I felt like by going there, I got to go back a generation, my own family, by being in their current generation. And I think that was also part of the pull for me.
I want to maybe, Elif has to go quite soon, so I wonder whether people from the youth panel have any questions for her, or anyone, in fact, anyone else has any questions for her, just to give her a chance to say. Yeah? Go ahead.
Me?
Yeah.
You talked about stereotypes. Some stereotypes are completely fake, right? They don't exist, and just sometimes we just make them up, really. But some stereotypes do exist in cultures. So in terms of love, you know, when you fall in love with someone from a different culture, and you find that those stereotypes are actually real. It's, for me, it's like that. Now I was going to talk about this after, but it's so important is to adapt. So I don't know if any of you had any comments on this, but it's like, do you reject those stereotypes? Do you go into a relationship and you're like, you have to change, you know? Or do you, as someone who loves you, you love your partner, do you adapt to the stereotypes and then hopefully you would adapt to your stereotypes as well?
It's beautiful. You know, I really think we need to talk about gender,
yeah,
because it wasn't very realistic if we, you know, speak as if gender distinctions did not exist. It's different for women. In the sense that, I mean, for instance, a Muslim woman falling in love with a Christian man is a different story. Or with a Jewish man is a different story, because the perception in the society is completely different. A Muslim man falling in love with a Christian woman is acceptable. It always was acceptable. So I think what women need to go through if they fall in love with someone outside their religion is much, much harder. Likewise, gay relationships, you know, falling in love with a gay man from a different culture, from a different class or religion, very hard, very, very hard. Some of the honor killings that we talk about, they were not only targeting women, they're also targeting gay men and transsexuals. So we need to put gender, I think, into this debate. But personally, I think, you know, if we're talking about love, the way I see it, and maybe writing the 40 Rules of Love was helpful for me, you know, like I have to think maybe a bit differently about these issues from the way I used to think before. You know, the more love there is, I think the smaller the ego, yeah? So there's an opposite relationship there. However, in our daily life, in our modern lives, it's the opposite. With love, our egos also grow, and then we start talking about my husband, my fiancé. We're proud of the beauty of our wife. We're proud of the power of our husband or the money of our husband. And it becomes an ego-building process. And I find that very dangerous. I think the ego needs to go down. And love is not about I. Yeah, I think.
Thank you.
And of course, if you're building a family, that's often the responsibility for that in Muslim societies often falls to the woman, and the woman's responsibility to raise the children within
Absolutely.
The religion as well.
Absolutely. That's the biggest issue, you know, if the mother passes their religion Yes. Yeah. Again, you know, especially when marrying a Jewish woman, these questions come up because you know, of the matrilineal name, you know, continuity. But these are very important, and I think it's really much harder for women.
Gender is at the heart of it, really. There's a moment in the novel which I, if I may say so myself, I like it. It's the patriarch of from the boy's family has ruined at least 3-4 lives around him, which are daughters and sisters. He has not allowed them to do anything that they like, which primarily means if his daughter has liked the next door neighbor's boy and he's from a different sect. The conversation is not even started. Such is the fear and the dread of this patriarch that the woman doesn't even raise it because she knows he's going to crush it. However, later in the story, he realizes what he's done. He's got this wake of broken hearts behind him, which include his two daughters and a sister. And when it comes to his brother doing the same thing, he agrees. He actually helps get married to the girl. Not only because this is different, because this is a male figure now and he doesn't have the same kind of issues. Also because he knows that what he's done in the past is miserable. He's wronged the women in his house because he's not allowed them to marry of their own choice. Which is what Samir was saying earlier, there are these rules which are different, you know. And the heroine of the novel, who I think is the heart of the book, she knows all this. She doesn't read books about it, but she knows she has an innate understanding of the patriarchal order around her. So what she does is, she doesn't choose to rebel outrightly. She doesn't go out in the streets and protest or writes a big op-ed somewhere. What she does is, she decides to be clever about it. She decides, I'm going to get my man. But I'm now going to fight with my mother and father because that's not going to get me anywhere. They're going to get me married off next day. She decides to be clever, and that was my way of suggesting how women, you know, survive and at least have a semblance of happiness and prosperity in that kind of male order. So she doesn't stage an outright rebellion. She goes about it cleverly. She makes schemes. She pursues her boy, but cleverly, slowly, gradually. Because she knows if she tells her father, I want to marry this man, he's going to get her married next day. Gender, yeah. I agree. This is kind of the
norm. Aline, I don't want to keep you because I think you might need to...
Is it 7:30?
It's 7:15 now. Can you stay for a while?
Yeah, I can stay.
Okay, great. Thank you. Yeah. Talking about gender, we were chatting before, actually, about the reactions of... that audiences have had to your book, and you said that there has been an interesting gender divide between the women who heard the story and the men.
And an age divide as well, actually. One of the things that's been most interesting to me is it seems that older women, women with more life experience, have been much less judgmental, much more receptive to my book, whereas I found younger women, when I read reviews that they write or when I talk to them about it, the word they use the most often is that the story made them very uncomfortable. The relationship made them very uncomfortable. I think maybe it's how we are as people. We have a very clearly established sort of buffer and comfort zone when we're younger. And when that gets challenged, we tend to draw back. And as we get older, we have more life experience, perhaps. We understand that, you know, relationships are messy and come in all kinds of shapes and sizes. And really, we should just find joy and beauty and love in whatever form it comes to us. But that's been quite surprising. And then... as well, I suppose, gender-wise, men, when they read my book, are very sort of, you go, girlfriend, and women are still sort of, what were you thinking? So that's been quite interesting as well. I think a story of a woman who rallies, and, I mean, it's a little bit goes to your question. Not many women, I think, Western women, would go through what I think I went through, to be with a man from such a different culture. I think they would just say, this is too much for me, I'm getting out, or I might have to give up too much of myself, or I'm not being feminist enough. And I think that that's been an interesting thing as well, as men, I think, appreciate that fact that I certainly can become a doormat or give up my identity, but the fact I was willing to go through it in the long haul is something unusual, I suppose.
Yeah, and those compromises that are needed within relationships across cultures are really important, aren't they? But I also wonder whether those kind of compromises are needed in any kind of relationship. And then when we're talking about love across the divide, maybe the biggest divide is with simply another person, and you could be from exactly the same background. But in a way, you're still having a kind of intercultural relationship, because two people from exactly the same culture could be incredibly different.
I think for me, the biggest divide is, you know, who we were before falling in love and after falling in love. You know, I think love is about change. It has to change us. We need to allow ourselves to be changed. So it's fluid, rather than, you know, trying to stay the same and changing the other person. So for me, that is the biggest divide, you know, the before and after of love.
Melissa, do you have any thoughts about that?
The divides, I mean, you see, when you mentioned that people from the same background, I mean, they will have differences, of course, inevitably. But there is no label. There is not a label on the forehead which says Hindu, Muslim, Shia, Sunni, you know, Christian, which definitely does play on your mind then, because you have, the moment you pursue this man or this woman and you know there is this label, he's not like me, she's not like me, the divide is a little more sharper. You know, there will always be differences, of course, you know, between, you know, two very, very similar people as well. But when you have the extra baggage of cultural, religious, ethnic differences, the most significant factor that comes into play is the respective societies having a say in determining your future.
So I may add, sometimes I think we have only one word. You know, we're speaking about so many different feelings and nuances, but we always use one single word, love. When I speak Turkish, I can use relatively maybe two words, aşk and sevgi, and there's a nuance there. But there's a part of me that longs for more words, because I think there
are... Tell us about those Turkish words, those different Turkish words.
I'm sure in Arabic there's even more, in Persian there's even more nuances, because the Turkish vocabulary was, you know, shrunk dramatically. Arabic has a bigger vocabulary in that regard. But what I'm trying to say is, you know, we, in order to be able to address these nuances, I think we really need different words. There are different forms of love, but somehow we can't talk about this. We're always using the same word. And to me, it's...
I think respect comes to my mind a lot.
Respect?
Yes, because not respect in the sense because we're talking about the other and differences, love across divide. Respect in the sense that, you know, because you, when you decide to be with someone who's very different from you and has a different cultural, historical baggage attached to them in ways you like and in some ways you may not be very comfortable with. That's where respect comes in, because you've decided to be with this person, and in many cases you've decided to pursue this person in spite of the differences, in spite of the problems it may present. Which, and if there is no respect, or there is not enough respect for what the person stands for, then even things like love, which is very powerful and strong, may not be sufficient. Because, you know, you've been with somebody for 10 years, love's running a bit short, or dry.
Also, what, you know, the accompanies, the word love, you know, the rest of the sentence, what you put next to it, the visuals, the images, I mean... Just a little anecdote, when the 40 List of Love came out in Turkish, there was only, we used only one word, aşk, which means love. And the book had a very pink cover. I myself was very biased against the color pink, but maybe I changed after, you know, my daughter, because, you know, the color pink invaded the house. But anyhow, the designer whom I worked with, he wanted to use the color of a heart chakra, and that's a very pink color. And we used the picture of a leaf from a tree. It's an X-ray technique. So the idea was, even the simple things in our daily life, if we care to take a look at, we see the details in them. It looks like a heart, like a, you know, heart throbbing with love. It's simple, but in my opinion, it was powerful in its simplicity. But when the book came out, there was a different gender reaction from male readers and female readers. Female readers were okay. Male readers in Turkey were very uncomfortable. And they started covering the book with newspapers. Because it was pink, because the word was love, So what kind of a book it is? It is not literary. It is, you know, a book about love. You know, how can I be seen reading this book? And it, in the end, it became such a big issue that we had to publish an alternative version, Smoky Gray, you know, the word loves in smaller letters for men who were not comfortable with the pinkness
with the pink.
And the heart and the word love.
Very interesting.
I wonder whether we can open up to the audience now. I'm sure you've got lots of questions for the panel. And if there's anyone else on the youth panel as well wants to say anything first of all.
I was
quite interested. Can you
tell them this for them? I was quite interested in hearing your thoughts on what you think about the situation now and how interracial relationships are today. I mean, society is quite accepting of it, but I grew up in India and I'm born and brought up there, and I still have friends who say, well, I want to marry an Indian man because he understands me, he understands my family. And I've been in a relationship with a very Christian Italian man in the last year. And they say, well, don't you want to be Indian wedding? Don't you want him to understand what India's about? And those are valid points. I do want him to understand what India's about. His family is very Christian, and I can sense that they're not very comfortable with the fact that I'm not that religious. And so I'm quite interested to hear about where you think the situation is now, today. I think society is accepting that.
Jennifer, what
I think I'm the perfect person to answer that question.
Yes, please.
My experiences are quite recent. So I think it's incredibly surprising how unaccepting in many ways society is. The amount of ignorance, obviously it depends on what culture that person's from, what culture you're from, but the ignorance is phenomenal around intercultural relationships. I mean, for myself, when I came back from Iran, it was like everyone just thought I became stupid overnight. Everyone just thought that I was crazy and that I didn't know what I was doing and that this wasn't a legitimate relationship and had no possibility of success, which really shocked me. It is shocking to see how your friends and your peers react to you when you embark on a relationship with someone from a very different part of the world who's very different from you. And I think Iran is a perfect country where people know so little about it, or they know what they see on CNN, which is women with mustaches and black outfits on with, you know, down America signs. That's all that they know. And so they kind of think you've been brainwashed and sucked into a cult, and they don't understand that there's a lot of beauty and richness in that culture that can also be part of that relationship. So, yeah.
We're going to have to just let the leaf go.
Thank you.
So please, could you just give a round of applause for the leaf? Thank you, Jennifer. What about the idea that,
can I answer the question?
Yeah,
a little
of course,
bit?
Exactly. Yes. Yeah, well.
Things get easier depending on where you are. I married a Pakistani, and we got married at the BBC, literally.
Oh.
Yeah. There was a reception on the top floor of Bush House. People just got together and they wanted a lovely party, and they booked on the conference rooms on the top floor, and there was a big, it was the only mehndi in the BBC ever, where people actually arranged all kinds of things, and there was a lovely sort of mehndi function on top of the BBC. And a week later, BBC used to have, they probably still have, I quit a few years ago, a very widely circulated newsletter called Ariel. And I see Ariel and I see myself on the front page wearing a ridiculous outfit. And my wife, of course, because somebody had decided that this is Love Unites India and Pakistan. It made a cheap, easy headline. It wasn't correct because I don't consider myself Indian, you know, technically speaking. But it was a moment of celebration for everyone around. It was wonderful in the way that there were two language services in the BBC, the Hindi service and the Urdu service. So the Hindi service and the Urdu service got together for this wedding, which was fantastic. So it's quite relative where you are, and of course there are cultural differences, there are prejudices, there are stereotypes, Latin prejudice is not going to go anywhere anytime soon. It keeps coming up, cropping up in all kinds of ways.
I can add to that a little bit in the fact that I found the situation with Vahid's family in Iran much, much worse than anything I experienced with my own family or anything here, which surprised me. I don't know why, maybe because I had no previous experience of it, but I'd never experienced that level of, I don't know, xenophobia, is that the right word? Where everyone just turns on you. As soon as you've crossed that line of no longer being the cute foreign guest in the house who's eventually going to leave and go away, everyone turns on you, and the things that are said and the assumptions that are made about you and your intentions, it was shocking for me. I remember very specifically having a conversation with my own mother about it, and I said to her, why are you okay with this when his mother so clearly isn't? She said, well, you know, your children are only on loan to you. They're only on loan to you for a period, and then you have to let them go, and if you did a good job, they will come back to you. And that's really your job as a mother, is that your child only belongs to you a period and you let them go. Whereas I think for him and for his family, his parents saw him very much as a car, and they could turn him left or right or any direction they wanted, and his job was just to follow that direction. And it was very different for me than the upbringing I had.
I'm so sorry. Kashmir wins. When my wife went to Kashmir for the first time, she was a celebrity. Seriously, because she was from Pakistan. You don't get legit Pakistanis into Kashmir. You know, you get Pakistanis, they will come by the border illegally. This was a legit Pakistani, and she was a celebrity. People would come to see her because I'd married a Pakistani, which was, yeah, it was, there was a bit of xenophobia because apparently people said to my sisters and my mothers, could he not find anyone here? Was there no one here that he had to marry? But yeah, but she was, you know, well loved mostly, and so. Somebody wanted to ask something, sorry.
No. Sorry.
No, Karen. Just one question. You worked in the BBC before. You mentioned media and how they portray Iranian women, for example. We both come from journalism degree, for example. And I just wondered, what's your opinion? What role does the media play in the way people look at marriage across different cultures? What role does the BBC play, for example? What role does other media organizations play in the way people?
So you're talking about the role of media?
Yeah, I'm talking about media in general, how they portray different cultures. Obviously.
Yeah, let the BBC, former BBC, man, answer this one.
Yeah.
Media is the same everywhere. If it makes a good, quick story, suits the agenda of the day, they will play it up, you know. If it checks certain boxes, you know, India, united with Pakistan via Lao or whatever, they'll go for it. If it's a, what the media should do though is talk more about the problems. If everyone loves a nice little story, you know, that love and so on and so on. What doesn't sell much is the problems, the troubles, is the violence meted out ever so often to women. In this context, in love across divide. And it's mostly women who are the victims. So media should do that. If I were to decide for the world's media today, you know, this is what they could do more often. Because even now, as we speak, there are thousands and thousands of women in Muslim cultures, non-Muslim cultures, in South Asia, in London, who pay dearly for simple desires.
Yeah. I guess that was kind of my question was, you know, media often portrays women rights in, for example, the Middle East, but sometimes we forget stories that, you know, women are suffering in the West,
yeah.
And that Western values are not right. You know, Western values are not right, and that's what, in terms of, for example, young feminism, as a young woman, you know, sometimes we are taught to hate men. You know, that's what they tell us in what we call white feminism. No man, say no to men. But actually, you know, Western values are not always right. They forget to tell us about the adaptation. You have to adapt about the cultures, and you have to learn how to accept other cultures.
Of course,
yeah.
Western values are not right.
Yeah.
There's prejudice in all societies of all kinds. You know.
I think the dangerous thing about media as well is, you know, a country like, I don't know, I'll say Yemen, for example, is probably not going to be in the news every day unless there's something very specific happening there. And the amount of exposure they'll get. You know, we live in the generation of the soundbite, so there might be a 90-second clip with, you know, lots of horrible images crammed into a very small period, and then it's over. And that will set your blueprint for what you think of Yemen. You may never see or read anything about Yemen ever again. So when you think of Yemen, you think of whatever horrible images you've seen, and that's it. And I know so many people who are incredibly well-traveled who, you know, as recently as 2 weeks ago said to me, is it safe to go to Iran? And I think, where do they get this idea from? Why do they think Iran is unsafe? Obviously, something they've seen maybe 30 years ago of people being taken hostage in an embassy, and that has set their template for their thinking.
Which still plays. The clip still plays every time.
Yeah, the grainy, fuzzy image from 1979. So I think the media plays a tremendous role, that I think you as an individual, you actually would have to seek alternatives. Go and see an Iranian-made film, and you'll see, for example, that Iran is very different. Go and watch a Separation, go and watch something, and you'll see that there's so much more to it than what you've seen in your 90
seconds. Or just meet people, like we were talking about earlier.
Exactly.
You know, it's a big question. We talk about, you know, the culture a lot, we're actually meeting people from their culture.
Exactly.
No, absolutely. Can I open up the questions to other people in the audience as well? Anyone to stick your hand up if you want to ask something? Yes, the lady there. Just hold on to the mic.
Hi. Thank you for your readings. I really enjoyed hearing your work. My question is kind of personal in the sense that I've mostly dated or been with guys from similar backgrounds myself, Indian background. And then for the first time last year, I was involved in a cross-cultural relationship. And it was a short one. But one of the frustrations I felt was that I felt like I was constantly explaining stuff. And I was abroad, so I was saying kind of, in the UK we do it this way, and in my family we do it this way, and in my culture we do it this way. And I felt like a good 50% of our conversation was me trying to explain why I saw the world differently, or why I did things differently. And I guess my question is particularly, did you find that? And if so, how do you kind of get past that? Because it just felt like it was a constant, like, almost like a comprehension test. And I didn't get past that stage myself, so I'm curious to see if you did and how.
Is that a question for me?
Yeah,
I thought so. I kind of experienced it, but I experienced the positive side of it, in the fact that, you know, one of the things actually that caused us to fall in love with each other was when Vahid learned that I was really only in Iran because I was obsessed with food and wanted to eat as much Iranian food as I could. He took me on this sort of food adventure, and we really fell in love eating, you know, sheep head and foot soup in these disgusting places, and, you know, heart and liver and sheep tail fat kebabs and whatever. And, you know, so I was actually just drinking it all up and soaking it all in. But then I remember when we met for the first time actually in Istanbul, which was sort of neutral territory for us. You do kind of embark on a sort of a, you know, my culture 101 exercise where you show them, I don't know, YouTube clips of things that you think will help inform their understanding. But I enjoyed that very much. I didn't feel the struggle that you describe. The only struggle, and it kind of ties back to your question, is there are points where that person will have a certain expectation of your behavior or your ideas, and you don't have that, you know, you won't behave that way, you won't do those things. And it's, I think, quite important to work out what your stake in the ground is going to be. I can give quite a personal example. I remember very specifically, we were talking on the phone one day, and I said, I'm off to go play squash. I used to play squash a lot, and afterwards, you know, all the girls get naked and have a shower together because that's what you do. There's showers and there's no dividers. And he said, well, make sure you cover your breasts up so that no one can see you. And I said, I'm not going to do that. It's only women. I thought his point was that there'd be men there and men would see me. But, you know, I said, no, it's only women. He said, still, you should cover yourself. And I remember thinking, I'm not going to cover myself. I'm never going to cover myself. And let me be clear now, that's just not something I'm going to be doing. And I think he just said, okay. But there are some amazing things that float to the surface that you don't expect. And you would never even imagine, I would never imagine that anyone would think, you know, okay, me streaking down Oxford Street, I can understand you might not be comfortable with that. But, you know, other women seeing me naked in the shower. So there are lots of things that float up where you have to negotiate. And it does get exhausting sometimes. And there are times when you kind of both have to retreat and think about it and come back to the table a few times. And I think part of it is understanding why they feel that way. Is it legitimate? And then for you, for myself, I remember very much thinking, if I concede on this, what will that mean for me? Because I do think sometimes it's like any relationship, you have to set the rules quite early, because if you don't and you let yourself go into a territory you're not comfortable with, backpedaling and regaining that territory, for lack of a better word, is very difficult, full of strife. So some of the things you mentioned I can relate to. I think I enjoyed the bits about explaining why things are the way they are, but I certainly had, you know, negotiations over things that were unimaginable to me before. I still shower naked, by the way, if anyone's curious.
Yes, there's a gentleman there.
It's great to hear stories about bridges across cultures to love. I'm just curious about your thoughts about bridges across castes when it comes to love. My parents are Hindu Brahmins, and I suspect my mother would be less horrified if I married a Christian or a Jewish person, or an African, or somebody. Perhaps not Muslim, that's not pushing. But I think she would be a lot more horrified if I married my brother or my cook. So is there an issue, any recognition, acknowledgement, or sensitivity about class across cultures?
Do you want to answer that first?
No, that's an important question. Class, of course, comes into play a lot. I like to think my second novel is a lot about class. I chose to keep certain characters who are not the same class as the patriarch's family. The boy's family used to be a grand family with money and stature and respect and so on and so forth. And the patriarch has always looked down upon the boys from the neighborhood. You know. One of the reasons he's not allowed his daughter to even contemplate a relationship with a man from a different sect is not only to do with the difference of sect, but because he drives an auto rickshaw. He's got a lowly job. He's not the same class. The girl knows that. You know, she's sort of, you know, looked at this boy and thought of a future with him, but she's never brought it up, because there's the double interplay of class and sect and everything. Class is, yeah, I think it's a very important question, because class, and we live in London, and there's been a government that has recently come to power. There's a few questions of class there. And I think the class divide is equally strong, if not more.
Yes, it's the Malvolio question, isn't it? Malvolio falls in love with somebody above his station, and it's a joke. Not Romeo and Juliet.
The question is over, isn't
Hello, Ashley.
One finds love in your story, but one also finds militarism. Right? I was wondering what militarism does to.
Oh, God. It destroys it, eventually. I mean, I'm not talking about the book alone, but because if there is a vast, brutal, horrific military machine that arrives in a theater of war in Kashmir or Iraq or Palestine or America now in a different context, it doesn't see nuance or complexity or moments of beauty or any such thing. It will just see people as numbers and figures and heads. It doesn't have time for such fine things in life, let alone tolerance. Conversely, love does become possible in such contexts. You know, there are many great love stories at times of great conflict, you know, across divides, across enemy lines even. You know. But when it comes to the final confrontation, you know, militarism, sadly, will always, nearly always, you know, win. Because what does it care about someone's fine heart or someone's obsession with beauty? It doesn't know those things. Even if it knows those things, it's got only one job, which is to destroy lives for whatever reasons, in a number of ways. And I know, I'm sorry, I sound a note of despair. It cannot work, you know, when if there's a confrontation. In the novel, there's a suggestion of it, you know, that once this vast military machine arrives, this boy loves to paint. You know, his life's ambition is to paint his masterpiece, where there is life and love and beauty and all those fine things. He can't, because he gets sucked into what you call this. This world of militarism, he picks a gun. So he tries to, I mean, even when he's training to kill, even when he's training to make bombs, he keeps thinking of the girl he loves. But eventually, will it survive against such colossal, massive forces? Sadly, no. I don't know if I answered your question, but, you know, it ruins those nice things.
That gentleman there. Yeah, to the lady, basically, for example, if you look at conservative society, then you're able to say your American family was more happy while your Iranian family was not. Because in conservative society, women tend to get married early and the marriage is seen as sacred, so there's many single women left behind, while for a liberal society, there's a lot of single men left behind. Is that the reason why your Iranian family was more like? They didn't like you very much because there's so many people within the society confined.
No, not at all. I think firstly, a lot of it was just the fact that I so came out of left field. I was so not in their plan for what they had in mind for their son. Someone once asked me, was Vahid expected to have an arranged marriage? The answer is no, not in the really traditional sense where, you know, here's your wife, you're going to marry her on Thursday. But they had some very clear parameters around the type of woman he'd be expected to marry. In fact, I remember in his room he had this drawer full of all his available cousins, you know, all photographs of them all made up and, you know. But I think what would have been expected would have been that he would have seen someone maybe in a cafe or a library and he would have liked the look of her. And his mother would have been very excited at getting that kind of inquiry into the family of the prospective girl and into their reputation. And in terms of the type of person that would have ticked all the boxes, the very first one, she would have had to have been a virgin. Absolutely. Never had a boyfriend, never even been in a chat room with a boy, innocent as, you know, freshly fallen snow.
How do they check that? Sorry.
You ask. I mean, the thing with Iran, and I'm sure many Asian countries and many Middle Eastern countries, is your reputation is pretty much follows you everywhere you go. If you set a foot wrong, everyone knows about it. So you would ask about that family, you'd ask about the daughter, you'd ask has she ever had any boyfriends. There'd be lots of ways you could find out. Then there would be the other obvious thing would be her age. She would be expected to be ideally 3, 4, 5, 6, 8 years younger than the man. They have an expression in Iran that is vulgar and horrible, but, you know, Iranian men must be head and shoulders above their wives in all aspects, height, experience, wisdom, knowledge. There's an idea that, you know, the woman would have been, or the girl would have been kind of meek and looking up and would have been not threatening, not challenging to him. She would have ticked a lot of those types of boxes. So you can imagine me, I was 6 years older, I had traveled a lot on my own, I lived on my own in an apartment, I'd had boyfriends before, I wasn't a virgin if anyone had any delusions about me. So I was nothing that they were expecting for him. And I think they had built up in their head that I was somehow, he was a cheap thrill for me. I think that was how they had written it in their mind, that he was kind of like I was a foreigner, I was coming, I was just playing, and then I would leave, and that would also have negative consequences for his reputation. So it had nothing to do, I think, with availability of, you know, local men for marriage or local women. I mean, there was a drawer full of cousins ready to go. I think it was just the fact that I was just so way off the radar of what they would have wanted for him and what they would have thought would have made a good match.
Okay. Do we have time for one more question? Or we, yeah. Well, one final question then.
Romances and these relationships, because I know it's forbidden in some senses, you don't talk about it, but yet I'm also aware that it's there, it's happening, and it's accepted, but you don't talk, you know, it's not mentioned. Are there current contemporary writers covering and telling these stories?
Hmm.
Or are you?
Yeah. I may, you know, if. I've read a lot of poetry from the East, as we sometimes call it conveniently, which is quite open and nice and frank about homosexuality. No, no, not just Rumi. I'm talking about, there was a great poet called Rangila in Mughal era. There is mention of homoerotic love in some Sindhi poetry, in, I don't know about Persian poetry a lot. There is, even in Urdu poetry, there is this concept of, you know, there are the two kinds of love, ishq-e haqiqi, ishq-e majazi, and everything. Sometimes the lover is male, you know. I don't, sadly, I can't recall at the moment if I've read any contemporary fiction, apart from the wonderful, wonderful Alan Hollinger's Line of Beauty, which was very well done. I thought it was brilliant. It wasn't about, only about homoerotic love, but it's one of the greatest sort of gay characters I've read. It was a few years ago, wasn't it, Line of Beauty?
Yeah, in 2004.
Yeah, it was Line of Beauty. And I recently read my friend Alex Preston's novel In Love and War, which is set in fascist-era Italy. And it's got great tracks on, you know, bisexuality or people falling in love you know, across genders. But
there's,
if
there's, of course, Hanif Qureshi.
There's Hanif Qureshi.
I think that's all we've got time for. Could carry on, but we have to end there. So if I could just ask you to give a big thank you to our writers, Jennifer Kaiser.